You can now take KRBN Internet News Talk Radio with you on your mobile phone, as we are making it easier to listen to the great hosts here on KRBN, including our very own West Lane County Commissioner, Jay Bozovich. It's free and available on Google Play. Just look for player.fm. That's player.fm and search for KRBN.
Live from Lane County, Oregon, it's the Boz Knows Show with your host, West Lane County Commissioner, Jay Bozovich. And now, here's Jay.
Afternoon, and it is a drop-dead gorgeous day here in the Pacific Northwest. I can't believe how nice it is. They were predicting scattered showers, and it's blue sky with those puffy clouds. You know, if you ever watch The Simpsons, you know, at the beginning of the show when they have The Simpsons up in the sky and there's like these clouds back off into the distance, we have a Simpsons sky today. Just such a beautiful day in the Pacific Northwest. You're listening to the Boz Knows Show, and I'm your host, West Lane County Commissioner Jay Bozovich. And just like every day, we are a free-for-all where if you want to change the topic we're talking about, just call us here at 646-721-9887 and press 1. And that lets Robin, my call screener and producer extraordinaire, know you want to get in on the conversation. And I forgot to mention, we are coming to you live from beautiful downtown Elmira, Oregon. And like I said, it's another beautiful day here in the Pacific Northwest. But it's one of those days where I'm not getting to enjoy it very much because my day started awful early. I got up this morning and went out to Junction City for the Tri-County Chamber monthly breakfast meeting starting at 7 a.m. this morning. And with the time change, it was still pretty dark. And from there, I had to run to the county for a two-hour work session on initiatives and referrals. And from there, I had to run my way out to Veneta for the Fern Ridge Chamber of Commerce quarterly lunch meeting. And from there, I had to kind of run home and take care of some other business, catch up on some of my email that built up during all those meetings, make a few phone calls. And now I'm doing the radio show. As soon as the radio show is done, I got to feed the poodles, feed the Jay, run out the door, and show up at the airport for an open house on their new master plan they're developing out there. I have to go from the airport out to Springfield for candidate interviews from one of the local labor unions. And I'll probably get finished sometime after 9 o'clock tonight. So makes for those long days, 14, 15-hour days that commissioners sometimes have when you start out with breakfast meetings and end up with evening meetings and everything in between. So I'm not getting to enjoy the weather too much except for going to and from my car. So I hope you're getting a chance to enjoy it today here in beautiful Lane County. But we talk about just about everything on the Boz Knows Show. But because I was at two different chamber meetings, and one of the topics that came up in yesterday's board meeting had to deal with jobs, so I've kind of got jobs on the brain. So I'm going to probably talk about jobs for a good portion of the Boz Knows Show today. And if you don't want to talk about jobs, you can just call in at 646-721-9887. Again, 646-721-9887. And we'll talk about what you want to talk about on the Boz Knows Show. But I'm probably going to go on about jobs a little bit today because I'm kind of excited in some ways. And I start going to chambers. You know, chambers are always nice, positive meetings to go to. Bunch of local businessmen, local owners a lot of times, or it might even be a franchise, but it's the local franchise owner or a local manager of that franchise. It's always great because it's like people that live and work in the community and hire people and just tend to be positive meetings anyway. But it's great to kind of just talk about economic development, and particularly the Fern Ridge Chamber today was specifically about economic development efforts. There was somebody there from Business Oregon, Sarah Means from our Community and Economic Development Department at Lane County was there. And there were a couple of folks from the city of Veneta there to talk about their efforts. And kind of what's interesting is how those all meld together. and even involve a lot of different partners. Like there was a particular effort in the Veneta area to bring some more high-speed data fiber network out to Veneta. And it involves actually the Lane Electric Co-op as part of that partnership to put that together. And Business Oregon and Lane County Economic Development, City of Veneta, and Lane Electric Co-op all working together to get what they call the middle mile done, which is going to run some fiber from the BPA substation on K.R. Nielsen Road down near Eugene out to the City of Veneta along Lane Electric Co-op poles, and it'll finish up a redundant loop to some other fiber that comes into this area. And because of that, FCR used to be called First Call Resolution, that has a call center out here, Veneta, is going to hire another 30 to 50 people if they get that redundant fiber in place, because they'll be able to sign a contract with a client that has to have that redundancy and backup on the data network, so that they're not the kind of call center that can ever be down. So that's one of the requirements of their contracts, is to have redundancy in the high-speed data network that serves the call center. And right now, FCR only has a single high-speed fiber link out to their site. If they get this redundant loop in from another direction, they'll be able to meet those redundancy requirements in the contracts and hire more people. They're already hiring a lot of people out there. They're close to 300 staff at that First Call Resolution, so it'll push them past 300 probably. Pretty amazing success story, which in itself was a whole effort of cooperation of multiple agencies to entice that company to open that business at a time when not a lot of businesses were being opened in Lane County. And it was an opportunity to just start the critical mass. Because FCR is there, now all the little restaurants and the shopping centers around that are a lot more profitable, because now there's this employee that has to go find lunch or dinner, depending on what shift, even breakfast, what shift these folks are working in the call center. It really adds a lot to those businesses. All the service industries around that, they get from the gas station to the bank that be getting the paychecks deposited at it, to even, you know, the local grocery store that folks are running into on their way home, you know, grabbing something that, you know, the wife, you know, called them during their shift or texted them and said, don't forget to bring home a dozen eggs, you know. So there's a lot that happens there. But that effort to get FCR there, again, was this joint effort, Lane County, Business Oregon, and the City of Veneta all working together. And we actually even had ODOT participating in that effort at that time, because we needed to get ODOT to fast track permits to actually build the fiber into that shopping center where FCR is located. So it was, you know, just an incredible joint effort. So, and a lot of the jobs initiatives around here, you can't point to one agency was the one that got that business to expand, or got that business to stay here, got that business started, or got that business to relocate to Lane County. It's almost always a team effort, and almost always a collaboration of agencies and even private entities that work together. Often chambers of commerce are involved in that effort. When I look at some of the other efforts that have happened around the county, and particularly when you think about the airport, you know, I'm going to be there tonight. In addition to extra routes like the San Jose route and a few others that we've added at the airport that have helped us get to that million passenger per year limit that changes the designation of the airport, and all sorts of interesting things happen at that point. That has been a joint effort. You know, some of the addition of those routes actually took commitments from local businesses that they're going to buy a certain number of tickets during a year. And, you know, Travel Lane promoting those routes, the Eugene Chamber stepping in and getting businesses to make those commitments, and, you know, even the University of Oregon utilizing those routes, et cetera. So it's just, there's all the time when you think of economic development and trying to bring jobs or keep jobs here in Lane County. It's almost always these team efforts, you know, which is something that gets me kind of revved up, because that's one of the things that, that we have to do as local government now, because we are limited. We don't have unending resources. We can't tax our way into prosperity and have all the resources we want to do things by ourselves. We have to find creative ways to work together as multiple local governments and agencies, and even with the private sector, to try and do some of these things that are going to add jobs to our community and add value and make it a more vibrant community. And that's really an exciting thing for me when we were able to do these things. And one of the things that, you know, happened last week, I got to attend an event on Friday, and my dog Ollie got to attend it with me. If you follow me on Facebook, you've seen the pictures of Ollie and me speaking at the Market District expansion announcement, but where Brian Obie and his son Casey Obie Barrett have announced that they are actually going to step up and break ground before the end of the year on the expansion of what they call the Market District. What the Obies have been able to do is to actually buy some of the surrounding lots around the Lane County lot that they put a 99-year lease in. They're actually going to redo some of the facades of some of the buildings and all that, and this new development. It's all going to tie together with the architecture and design concepts of the Fifth Street Market and some of the surrounding buildings, to where it's going to look like a big area that was developed with a common theme. And it's going to be really vibrant too, because what one of the things it has in it is this large apartment building that's going to have people living in downtown. And that's a real key thing for the whole thing, is bringing people into downtown and adding more housing to the area. We've talked about housing on the show before and how important adding housing is. But that's really the addition of those living spaces right in downtown, next to a three-story retail center, where they're going to have this great local shops similar to the Fifth Street Market. It's going to kind of be a reflection of that. And then there's going to be another boutique hotel called the Gordon on the site, about 60 rooms, similar to the Inn at the Fifth. So you're going to have a couple more hotels there. And then across the street on the other portion of Lane County property that's involved in this 99-year lease, there's going to be a five-story building where the upper four floors are going to be workforce housing developed by the local housing authority, Homes for Good, and the lower floor is going to be retail that's going to be managed by the Obie folks. And so it kind of extends that all the way down 6th Avenue, as you think about it, from High Street all the way past Oak to the other side of Oak Street there, that corner of Oak and 6th. So it's going to be this several blocks of this development. And it's going to be really exciting, because they're going to put a glass roof between the apartment building and the retail building. So it's going to create this roof mall area where they're going to have the seating outside. So you think about some of the folks that like to bring their dogs with them to get a cup of coffee or eat lunch. You know, outdoor seating is really nice. And I've done that before over there at the Steelhead Brewery. I've sat outside with my dogs and had a meal there. But that's fine when it's nice out, sunny, and a little bit warmer. But this glassed-in area is going to give them an opportunity to do patio-type heaters and be out of the rain, to where they're going to be able to extend that season quite a bit, where you're going to be able to actually kind of be dining outdoors or having a cup of coffee or sitting there using Wi-Fi and just on outside instead of inside, where I might be able to enjoy a beautiful day like this. I probably should have dragged my computer outside today. 2020 hindsight. But yeah, it's just an amazing little development that Obie's doing. And he's doing it because Lane County made the space available and is working in partnership with them and Homes for Good. So we've already got private sector, county government, and the housing authority involved. And at the same time, there's probably going to be some involvement with the city of Eugene through possibly their MUPTI, their multiple unit property tax, stands for exemption. Yeah. Multiple unit property tax exemption, which will help finance, you know, in the finances of the apartment building. But it's a $60 million investment the Oakleys are making on their portion of the block, not to mention the investment of Homes for Good will be across the street. In addition, they're going to be doing quite a bit of investment and upgrades to the buildings there across the way. And it's going to really make this neat district down there for stores and restaurants and shops, coffee shops and all that stuff, and people actually living there. And that's just one part of what's going on in downtown. Because along with that, there's some other things happening that are also collaborations and cooperations, public-private. You've got the city of Eugene that's redeveloping the EWEB waterfront site with their partners, and I can't remember the name of the company, something or other, Damewood. But that's going to be redeveloped. So there's going to be this waterfront project going on the EWEB site. There's going to, you know, you walk across the railroad tracks and you get into the district market there. And then if you kind of think about where we've got our parking garage now, that's kind of sits, you know, it's going to now be across the street from the market district. There's some potential for us to redevelop that parking garage and possibly include an expansion of the convention center that's needed in order to keep our convention center competitive regionally and nationally. Needs to have another grand ballroom that's about twice as big as the existing grand ballroom, because we're outgrowing that site, and possibly maybe some hotel space above that. Might be another public-private partnership opportunity there on that site. And then as you go a little bit further to the south there, you get to where there may be a new courthouse and a new city hall and a permanent farmers market site. And so you think about all these things happening in downtown Eugene and just the critical mass that starts to form, let alone the night camp science campus that they broke ground for last week, or the week, was that 2 weeks ago they broke ground on the night science campus there. And that's going to bring hundreds of jobs. Again, you think about Eugene, that's on the waterfront a little bit to the east. You come down Franklin Boulevard and you hit the EWEB waterfront property that's going to redevelop into housing, shop, hotels, et cetera. And then you come across the railroad tracks and you get into the Fifth Street Market District and all what Brian Obey and Homes for Good are doing there. And then we have the possibility of a convention center and hotel expansion going on. And then you come a little bit further up and we've got, you know, a new court facility and we have a permanent downtown farmers market location. It's going to make for quite a change in Eugene, a really vibrant downtown and a really exciting downtown. And that, again, is involving all sorts of people from Travel Lane, City of Eugene, University of Oregon, private developers, the Chamber of Commerce, you know, a bunch of partners out there. And it's just exciting, especially when Brian Obey talks about having his development done by 2021 for the World Games. And I don't know where the schedule on some of the other developments might be, but it'd be, you know, just think about how that will look for the world as they come in here to go to the 2021 Worlds. Yeah. When I first came to Eugene in 1992 for a bicycle race, one of the places I stopped was at Fifth Street Market, where my wife found Mindy's Needlepoint. And it was one of the things that sold my wife on moving to Oregon was, hey, there's Needlepoint stores here too. But no, it wasn't just that. It was, you know, we enjoyed Mindy's, but it was also Steelhead Brewery. We had never had microbrew. In 1992, it wasn't a nationwide craze. It was really a Oregon thing, and it was new. And the idea of going someplace and they handed you what they called a board of all these beer samples and little tiny glasses, we had never seen or heard of anything like that. And we had never tasted beer like that. Of course, it was my immediate desire then to constantly drink microbrew instead of Budweiser. But that was just, between that, the great coffee, the art scene here and everything, it was really easy for us to look at this area and say, wow, this is a vibrant place that we would like to live. That same thing could be even more magnified by all these developments when the 2021 worlds come here and people see what a vibrant area this is. And not maybe necessarily come to live here, but come back and visit or stay longer and really help our economy out as we look to expand our tourism economy in Lane County, which is a really important piece of our economy here. So I've been droning on a little bit about jobs and the economy and developments and exciting collaborations and partners and all sorts of stuff. I want to hear from you, though, because that may not be what's on your mind. You may want to talk to me about school walkouts or something else. So give me a call here at Bo's Nose Show, 646-721-9887. Just press 1, and that lets Robin, my call screener and producer extraordinaire, know you want to get in on the conversation. And hopefully she'll be able to help you out because she is had a little oral surgery the other day, and I know she's suffering to some degree, but she managed to have a conversation with me before the show. So hopefully she'll be able to take your call and get you in the queue. Again, 646-721-9887. Just press 1. So I want to talk a little bit about initiatives, just because we had a 2-hour work session today. And if anyone got a chance to watch the work session, we didn't really finish our conversation, which was unfortunate, but it's one of those things when we do Wednesday morning work sessions, the city of Eugene has work sessions at noon and they need to get in the room early. So we've got a hard deadline. We have to stop at 11 o'clock. We just can't go on. So it, unfortunate thing was we didn't quite finish our conversation, make it complete, but we did finish the conversation about initiative process, which was the first half of the work session, and particularly citizen initiative process. And, I've talked about this briefly on the Bo's Nose Show before. There's a difference between a citizen initiative process, which is citizens making law, and the board referring something to the voter make law. And that's really a big distinction, because in the citizen initiative process, whether it's to amend our charter, and likewise, you can do the same thing, amend the Oregon Constitution, or going to just pass a statute or a code amendment or an addition to our code, which is an ordinance in our case, that citizen initiative process is something that the board is not involved in. And that was made really clear this morning. And those of you that are out there that have heard that somehow or another, the Lane County Board of Commissioners held up a couple of initiatives that were trying to get on the ballot or done something to hold them back or took some action or failed to take action, we clarified that this morning. We had an open discussion that no one could disagree with, that there was no action that this the Board of Commissioners took, or no action that we failed to take that either interfered with or prevented the aerial spray ban or the community rights initiative petitions to qualify and get on the ballot for May. We have not been involved in that process because the process for initiatives is citizens making law. There is no role for the Lane County Board of Commissioners. Now, there is a role for the Lane County Clerk by our charter and also by Oregon statute to run the elections, which they have to do certain things. Like at the beginning of the process, they have to check to make sure that the initiative is actually a single subject. And because of some lawsuits and judge determinations, after the signatures were determined to be valid, There was also a review for what they call separate vote to make sure that it didn't combine several different decisions into one vote. And that was what was recently ruled on by Judge Rasmussen last week, that basically said it doesn't qualify for the ballot. At no point were the commissioners involved in that process. And at no point are we even able to be involved in the process. So if we were even to start directing the clerk in that process, we'd be interfering with a statutorily prescribed process, and we'd be making ourselves liable to get sued and have all sorts of ethic complaints and other violations charged against us. So really clear this morning, the conversation we did finish was about the initiative, citizen-led initiative process, and there is no role for the Board of Commissioners, and there's nothing that the commissioners have done or failed to do that interfered with the process of the chief petitioners for either the aerial spray ban initiative or the community rights initiative. So if you've heard from somebody out there that that we did something to interfere with that process and have been interfering with citizens' voters' rights or something like that, you've been hearing false statements. So that is the clearest and easiest thing I can tell you that came out of this morning's meeting. When we got into the referral process, it got a lot more complex. And that's because the referral process is the commissioners taking their discretionary authority to make a law and place it on the ballot for the citizens to vote on that making law, which leads to actual liability to the Tulane County. So if we were actually to refer something to the ballot that was knowingly illegal, we could actually create, you know, multi-million dollar lawsuit liability against Lane County. We at least uncovered that in the conversation, but we didn't get far enough to really get to a final conclusion about the referral process relative to if the commissioners wanted to refer either of those two citizen-led initiatives, the aerial spray ban or the community rights initiative, to the ballot, either as a charter amendment. Actually, we determined as a charter amendment, it would still have to go through the separate vote and would have failed. So that's kind of off the table as a charter amendment. The question was, could we do it as an ordinance, which wouldn't have to meet the separate vote requirement? But then we get into the issue of, are we creating a liability for Lane County and thus the taxpayers of Lane County to pay large legal settlement if we try and refer something to the ballot that we know violates state law or federal law or is outside of our powers to actually legislate? Because one of the things under our home rule charter through the Oregon Constitution, Article 6, Section 10, is we really only have authority over things we have jurisdiction on. And there's several things that the legislature has specifically said counties don't have jurisdiction on. One of them, which is farm practices, including pesticide and herbicide application rules. So, you know, there's a definitive prohibition against us having laws relative to that. So us referring a ballot measure that has some kind of ruling on that flies in the face of state preemption on that and would actually create a liability for the county for having done so and maybe costing people money running campaigns or having to go through the legal process to get it invalidated. And then whatever legal money they spent might be, the county might be on the hook for. And you get some of these high powered firms out of Portland or Seattle making those arguments and you're talking a lot of dollars. So, you know, we didn't get down to whether we were actually going to do anything relative to those things today because we ran out of time, but it definitely there was, we uncovered the fact that there is liability involved in taking those actions. So covered a lot of ground here in the first half hour of the Bo's Nose Show. We've covered jobs and downtown redevelopment initiatives and referrals. Talked briefly about the airport. I might want to get back to that a bit. And then I might want to talk a little bit about school walkouts because I've got a different direction I want to talk about that. It, not necessarily, you know, why the kids are walking out and any solutions to school violence, et cetera. It's about, you know, the whole idea of civil disobedience and kids. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes, maybe. I want to talk about the airport for a minute, because it's kind of one of those gems that I don't think people quite understand how fortunate we are here in Lane County to have the Eugene Airport. And it is a municipal airport owned by the city of Eugene, but it functions as a regional airport. We have people coming to that airport from all over, Lane County, Linn County, Benton County, Douglas County. They even come over from Bend and up from Clackamas, you know, because sometimes it's just nearly impossible either to get from Medford or Klamath Falls into Eugene and then change a flight, or from there into San Francisco. Such limitations. The airport is just a great asset to have, because when it comes to economic development and trying to get firms to locate here or stay in this area, to keep a firm like Johnson Crushers that designs and constructs this rock crushing equipment that's sold internationally. I mean, they sell to China, they sell to Europe, they sell to Africa, and they could be located anywhere. But they're staying here, you know, they started here and staying here in Eugene. But one of the things that keeps a company like that here is their ability to get their sales crews and their maintenance and setup crews over to some other country and be there when the equipment's delivered, help us set it up and, you know, run through all the startup procedures and warranty issues and whatever else and maintenance. That ability to fly in and out of Eugene helps keep a company, a local, high-paying, family-wage job company like Johnson Crushers in this area. And that's, you know, really, that airport really helps us with that. So it's one of the reasons why I'm going to take the time to go to the open house tonight to learn more about what the future plans are for the airport. You know, what's kind of interesting is I've been looking at that airport master plan for a long time, because one of the first things I got involved in when I was at Eugene Water Electric Board was expanding the water mains out to the airport so they could get a higher level of fire flow out there, because they're going to add those helicopter hangars on the north end of the pools, and they needed to have 3,500 gallons per minute firefighting capability, which they didn't have at that point. So we had to design a new water main out to the airport that was going to connect in from the north and loop their system in. And lo and behold, the new water main we were going to run out Aubrey Lane out there to Green Hill before they relocated Green Hill and all that. This was before the second runway. We had to design that based on the master plan and the second runway and get it deep enough and out of the way of the future runway. So I've been seeing airport master plans since the 90s and watching the growth of that airport in one way or another. And it's pretty amazing, you know, the second runway, the expansions in the terminals, they've gone along. You know, we all remember when they started having to do the bag, checking bags for explosives and all that stuff, how we used to have to walk our bags across the terminal and into the area where they would actually take them through the bomb sniffing equipment and all that stuff. And now you don't have to do that because they expanded the baggage handling areas behind the counters, and now all that stuff's behind the counters, so you don't have to walk your bag across the airport terminal to another area. You know, it was really awkward. And now they've expanded some of the seating areas for the B terminals, and they've for the security check-in. So now they can actually have a fast lane for the TSA pre-check. They've actually expanded the luggage pickup area. So there's actually now more than one luggage belt at the airport. You know, what's next? What are they thinking of next? You know, they're now talking about direct flights from San Diego into the airport, which is nice, because my wife just flew back from San Diego yesterday. And because President Trump flew into San Diego yesterday morning. Her flight got held up because they shut down the runways a half hour before and a half hour after the Air Force One lands. And she had to run through San Francisco Airport to make her connection. Now, if she'd have been on a direct flight, that wouldn't have been an issue. But she was really lucky. She made her flight, her baggage made her flight. And she got here when she was supposed to get here. But at first, when they announced the delay, they actually ended up not delaying the flight as long as they thought they were going to. They got off the ground sooner. That's why she made her connection. But when they first announced the delay, she was going to miss her connection. And you never know. The flights from San Francisco tend to get more crowded the later in the day, getting into Eugene because the flights from the East Coast start reaching San Francisco. Whether she would have gotten in yesterday at all. So a direct flight from San Diego helped bypass San Francisco, which a lot of times is a problem airport. It's an airport that quite often has delays because they are so busy, they fly their flights in so close together, but if they get a little bit of rain or fog, they have to separate flights, and they lose about 50% of their capacity by having to put the distance between flights longer, and it'll back flights up for hours there. And it's just, I'd be so happy to have more direct flights into Eugene. But what's next? Where do you want Eugene Airport folks to focus on the next nonstop flight? Think about that. Where do you fly to regularly, or what would make it more convenient? Or what city that has good connections to other places you want to go would be a lot more convenient? You know, it's great we go now to Denver and Salt Lake because they have a lot of connections out of there. Now, what's next? A direct flight into Chicago so you can get all those various flights out of Chicago O'Hare? Where would you want to go? So I'm kind of curious about that. Give me a call here, 646-721-9887. Again, 646-721-9887. Just press 1, lets us know you want to get in on the conversation. Tell me where you want the airport to go. Are you one of those folks that lives under the flight path? Is there anything you want to tell the airport about that? That's always a concern. As they expand the number of flights and start using that alternate runway, which they did for a while they were doing some repairs of the older runway, there are some people that realize that flying into that other runway kind of changes the jet noise a little bit. Some of those folks in North Bethel and over in South Junction City had a sudden realization that although those two runways aren't that far apart, it does change the flight pattern somewhat. But so that's kind of where I'll be at that airport open house tonight, looking at that master plan. But I want to get in on the conversation of school walkouts, because I think Robin's got a few thoughts about this too. But I want to talk first about my thoughts. And that's one of the things this walkout is it's a protest by civil disobedience. And one of the things I'm concerned about was I was seeing reports as these were being planned and all that. And I don't know. We'll find out more after the kids have actually walked out, where school districts, some of them were saying up front, we're not going to give the kids detention. We're not going to mark them tardy or that they missed a class. We're giving them the opportunity to participate, without any ramifications. And that kind of makes me upset. And it's not that they're getting why they're walking out or anything like that. It's the concept of that not having ramifications. The whole point of civil disobedience is to do something knowing it may have ramifications. If you remove the ramifications, it's not an act of civil disobedience. And it's not a true protest, and it's not meaningful, really, for the students to participate. If they're not going to get a detention, if they're not going to get a tardy mark, then they're not risking anything. And they're not making a real statement, if you know what I mean. When Gandhi walked up to the British and said he wanted to get salt, and then they you know, were whipped with sticks for having done so. And they continued in a line of men continually walking up and getting whipped with sticks till the soldiers got too tired to whip them. You know, that act of requesting to make salt because the British were controlling the salt supplies as a means of power over the Indian citizens, that act of civil disobedience of asking to do so, knowing that there was a whipping coming, was the form of nonviolent, peaceful civil disobedience that meant something. So these kids walking out of their classes, knowing there were no ramifications, aren't really participating in a meaningful piece of protest and civil disobedience. So I commend the districts that are actually going to take some kind of, you know, it doesn't have to be harsh. I don't think they need to be expelled or suspended over a 17-minute walkout. But what they should at least get is marked absent for that time period or tardy. And maybe even a during lunch detention sentence of some kind, or a half hour after school detention, just so there's something that those kids have at risk for taking that action. And to me, that's really, we're not teaching the kids a good lesson if we don't have ramifications to some kind of form of civil disobedience protest. It's not a walkout if they're all excused to do it. So that's kind of my two cents on the school walkouts today. I think, you know, Robin, you were telling me you had some other concerns about it, which, you know, kind of get into more of the content of the walkouts and why they're doing them. My criticism is, doesn't matter why they're walking out, they should have to suffer consequences for participating in a walkout.
Well, and you know, I think one of the consequences for that would be to spend one class period with a history lesson. For example, yeah, these kids that don't know what July 4th is all about.
Yeah, you've connected me with some of those videos about people being interviewed. You know what we're celebrating on the 4th of July?
Beer.
Yeah, fireworks.
Yeah.
People can't tell you. And even when the guy goes, on the 4th of July is Independence Day, do you know what we declare our independence from? And people can't answer that question.
Exactly. And I think that would make, and my humble opinion, if students knew more about, like, the history a little bit better, then they maybe would understand more about why they're walking out or what effect it would have, instead of just, I understand they're scared, they see this going on, they're acting emotionally, they want to be safe, understandably, they're probably not seeing anything happening, but again, you know, do they really understand the ramifications of, you know, tighter gun control laws, just like the example of where more crimes happen in safe zones, gun-free zones.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of what kind of got lost a little bit in some of the reporting. The reporting today talked about the students walked out for tougher gun laws. And I don't think that's all they walked out for. I think they walked out for safer classrooms, to be honest. And tougher gun laws may be one of the ways they get to safer classrooms, but the media seems to be focusing on just that one.
Mm-hmm.
Not others.
Well, when you listen to some of the talk shows and people calling in, you know, saying more scanners at the door, badges and everything else. I mean, compared to when I went to school, in fact, looking at the junior high or middle school or whatever it's called now, Shasta, you know, where you didn't have to go through a gate to go from the class to the street. You know, now they're getting to be like a prison in a sense. And what type of environment does that create?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's, you know, these classrooms are really getting, it does kind of create, you know, there's this, you want to keep people safe, but you don't want to create this sort of prison sort of mentality. And this, you know, there is, I was listening to another show this morning. They were talking, you know, it was our good buddies on the wake up call talking about how they really have gone too far sometimes with protecting kids with, you know, getting rid of dangerous playground equipment and all that stuff. They're talking about how scraping your knee teaches a kid a lesson to be more careful the next time. The scraped knee is part of what reinforces that lesson, and how we want to make, you know, playgrounds so kids don't get scraped knees. We want to make schools so absolutely safe. You know, how do people, you know, learn some lessons? But also, you know, this whole issue of trying to make a building absolutely safe. I'm faced with that conversation now, and there was actually an editorial in the Guard this weekend about it's really easy to add security. It's really difficult to remove it in the future.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, we had a threat against the Board of Commissioners and some of our staff. So we added metal detectors and armed law enforcement officials to our board meeting after that threat. And the threat hasn't gone away, unfortunately. But how long do we keep metal detectors and armed law enforcement in the room?
Yeah.
You know, when do we stop? And how does that make the public feel welcome at our meetings?
Well, and there's an old saying, too, is that how much of your freedom are you willing to give up for the illusion of being safe?
Yeah. Because when it comes down to it, yeah, so now we maybe made our meeting a little safe. So they maybe refocus on other places commissioners show up. You know, because we, you know, people know in advance a lot of our schedules. We advertise all of our subcommittee meetings and meetings we have with other agencies where there might be a quorum of commissioners present. We have to put it, you know, because public meetings will all require us to. So whoever might have threatened violence against the commissioners may show up at a different venue now that doesn't have the metal detectors and the armed guards, just because they know the commissioners are there. So does it really make us safe to do that? It makes that one meeting safe, but you know, I have all the rest of the week I have to deal with.
Well, that, how many people want to come to the meetings if they have to go through airport security?
Yeah, and that's basically what's going on. And so, yeah, that whole idea of how much do you armor the building, you know, and what kind of environment does that create for the students? You know, when we talk about, you know, our elected officials having meetings and having security, how much does that make the public feel welcome to come there and have redress with their elected officials? So it's a tough question and one that I don't think is easily solved, but it is, you know, it really requires looking at the broad spectrum of things. I saw a great post today about instead of walking out, walking up, walk up to somebody and offer to be their friend, you know, walk up to somebody and tell them that you'll be their partner, you know, when they don't get somebody that jumps up and says, I'll be your lab partner. You know, those sort of things, you know, walk up to somebody and just be nice to them.
Is that PC?
Yeah. Well, I didn't say hug them.
Well, in this day and age, walking up to somebody, go, can I be your friend? Might be misinterpreted.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you don't have to say, can I be your friend? But you can at least say, how you doing? You having a good day? You know?
Yeah.
What you do? You know? Start a conversation. You know, be a friend to somebody.
Well, I got a question for you.
Sure.
Getting kind of back to the school shootings and whatnot, you know, and gun-free zones, is, have you ever gone through a gun safety course?
Me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Now, I don't know how in-depth, I'm going to claim ignorance here because I've never gone through one, but going through that course, do they just teach you gun safety or do they actually teach you confrontation?
The course that's required to get a concealed handgun license or concealed weapon license, I think it's CWL in the state of Oregon, is the basic gun safety course. And there's an NRA version of it. That basically just teaches you safe handling of weapons and basic gun safety. It does not talk about confrontation, doesn't talk about the law behind confrontation. The course I took was beyond that.
Okay.
It went through all the gun. It went through all the requirements that are required to get the coursework you need to sign up and apply for CWL. But it also included some information on the law about, you know, when you're legally allowed to use your weapon, what's brandishing, you know, various things like that. And then it involved actual range time, where we went out with a couple of certified range instructors. One of them's a former Marine sniper. The other one's got NRA master certification that runs the range I went to. And we went through first all the basic safety stuff, learned to, you know, handle our handguns and everything else in proper stances and how to draw and everything else about that and shooting for, you know, accuracy and everything. And then we went beyond that. We went to how do you deal with certain situations, and they had simulations with fake walls that you had to walk around and silhouettes, and some of them were good guys and some were bad guys, and they would set the situations up without your knowing exactly what it was. And it was rough ground that you had to learn to not be looking down and walking correctly, heel toe and all that. It was, so the safety course I went through was basically almost the same thing cops go through.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm going with that. I'm in favor of concealed carry and even concealed carry in school by the teachers if they take it to that extent, so they're trained not only in the safety but also how to handle a situation, you know, above and beyond just the basic concealed carry course.
And you know, the biggest thing people need to know is escape is the first option.
Right.
You know, if you can actually, you know, even if somebody comes in your house, you don't have automatically the right to shoot them in this state. You know, their entrance into your house is, you know, especially if you have the ability to leave by back door.
Right.
If you could easily escape and instead you choose to confront and shoot, you may be in a heap of trouble in a court of law after the fact.
Yeah, so,
understanding those things is important if you're going to have a firearm in your possession. The other thing is you can't shoot somebody over a property crime. Yeah. You know? It's just there is no threat of life in that, shooting somebody.
Well, as Nero can't do it.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
You have an audience.
Yeah. My neighbors are doing something with a lawnmower or a rototiller next door, and it stalled. And then when it went to restart, it backfired, and that got the dogs going.
Speaking of bangs.
Yeah. Fortunately, I knew what that one was, but dogs didn't.
Yeah. Now that's kind of what I'm thinking of though, because if they're trained above and beyond, because if everybody carries, there's going to be incidents, but if you're trained and you have continuous training, especially if you're going to be carrying in a school, then, and it's well known that the teachers, but you don't know which teachers have it, then in theory it would make them less of a target because the chances are the target can shoot back or defend themselves, unless somebody's going in strictly for, you know, suicidal. But you know, I'd look at the numbers and take it from there.
Anyway, at least having that would be a deterrent, and at the same time it would also, if there is an incident, possibly limit the number of injuries and casualties.
Exactly.
The response time of a teacher a couple classrooms away is
far greater than the response time of the local police department. I mean, there is a long article in the Register Guard recently about the fact that the city of Eugene isn't responding to all their calls for service because they don't have enough officers to cover it, and that their response times have actually increased over the years to be rather lengthy. So, and if you're expecting the police to be the solution, most of these incidents are over with in 4 to 5 minutes. And that's long past the response time for EPD in this area, let alone if you're, say, Crow High School out in Crow, and you're a good distance away from any officer.
Well, and publicizing that is just like, I can't remember how many years ago it was, when they were trying to get more money because of budget cuts, where the DA actually came out with his list of 100 things we will not respond to, which, yeah, on the other hand, is telling the criminals, oh, hey, guess what we can do, and nobody's going to bother us.
Yeah.
You know, good call, guys. But, yeah, it's the same thing. Just like that military base where they weren't allowed to carry weapons and 5 sharpshooters were killed because they didn't have their guns on them.
Yeah. Yeah, folks that are definitely trained and able to respond in that sort of situation, too.
Exactly. That's the worst part about that. Well, I mean, compared to the death, but you know what I mean?
And there's the whole other issue on this. This kid had been identified by multiple people as somebody that was a potential threat, that had mental issues, and slipped through the system so many times where, if he had just been connected to the right kind of mental health and treatment, this may never have happened, that Parkdale shooting.
Unless he was chewing a part.
And there's multiple examples of that where there was indications beforehand and just something that fell through the cracks in our mental health system.
Well, was it that, or was it just the fact that they didn't want to deal with him?
I don't want to speculate because I don't have all the information, but I know that he was clearly identified in multiple occasions as having either conflicts with law enforcement or being reported to law enforcement in various agencies. And it seemed like there was so many opportunities to refer this troubled individual to mental health professionals, whether it was referred voluntarily when he was a little bit younger, or as he got older and became a more specific threat, whether that had to be a court-ordered referral and non-voluntary. Either way, it seemed like there were multiple opportunities missed to intervene with that particular individual. And then the question is how did that individual get to that state of mental health in the first place, which leads to the whole question of that walking up instead of walking out. Not letting folks become isolated, not bullying, and doing all the things that drive a person into that isolation and that, where they lose that connection to humanity, where they can carry on an action like this.
Yeah, he could have been really abused as a child, and it just festered.
Yeah, and I don't think it was so much an abuse case as it was a peer issue with this particular kid.
Yeah. Hey, Jay, in the last 30 seconds of the show, if it's okay, I'd like to throw out there, if people have an opinion on how they feel about concealed carry in schools or a solution, to post it on our Facebook page.
Yeah. We'll be, Facebook page is always a great place to talk to us. And, of course, you can also email us at talk@krbnradio.net. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. So I want to thank everybody for listening to Bo's Nose Show this week. I think next week may be one of those shows where I'm going to have to rearrange the time, because I think we've got a couple conflicting commissioners events. But I will double check to make sure and let you guys know well ahead of time if we have to shift the show. But until next week, we'll be talking to you again, live from beautiful downtown Elmira, Oregon. Thank you for listening to Bo's Nose Show. Have a great week.
Okay, we're clear. I don't know if the music started up or not. I couldn't hear it.
I couldn't hear it either. I started clicking in the episode.